Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an Oxford art historian, a writer and a broadcaster, and I am your chief investigator of images. Every week I will be joined by a wonderful assistant, and today I'm particularly delighted to be joined by my colleague, Professor of Mathematics, and you've got this wonderful title here, Simony Professor for the Public Understanding of the Sciences.
That's right.
And your name is Marcus de Sautoy.
Oh, great to be with you.
Big intro there, Marcus.
Yes, big title with big expectations.
Big
Everyone
expectations.
Always expects that I must know the whole of science, and here I am to explain it to you all. But now we're going to try and mix some science and art together.
We are. We're going to do something radical today with Art Detective. This is something that we're both interested in, isn't it? We love this idea of kind of crossing disciplinary boundaries, pushing the understandings of where we get to within my discipline of art history, your discipline of mathematics, and where we can go with it. So we're going to have some fun today because we're talking about Jackson Pollock. And in particular, if you want to look it up, the clever people at History Hit have embedded the image into the podcast, so you can click on the link and see it. But you can also type it into your search engine. And it is called simply Number 5. And it's painted in 1948. So you can type in Pollock, Number 5, 1948. Pollock is a controversial painter for lots of reasons. Everyone likes him, do they?
Well, I think a lot of people feel, anybody could make these paintings. I mean, I've got three kids who very often at the end of a painting session, the room looks like a Jackson Pollock because, you know, what is Jackson Pollock doing? It looks like, I mean, he's these famous drip paintings. So he sort of scatters paint across a canvas. And frankly, it looks like anybody could do it. So when this painting, which sold for at the time, I think it was the most anyone had paid for a painting. It was something like 75 million pounds or something.
£75 million.
Unbelievable. Yeah. And a lot of journalists said, oh, come on, it's just a load of paint being scattered around. So I think it really does divide opinion because people feel like, well, what's so special about this? Mm. But the amazing thing for me is that there is something very special about it, but you need mathematical eyes to be able to actually decode why Jackson Pollock is doing something special.
Mm. And this is something that you touched on in your book, The Number Mysteries. I was absolutely intrigued by this because this is a wonderful, I love that book. I mean, you've got your new book out at the moment, What We Cannot Know, which is also brilliant. We'll go on and talk a little bit about the limits of our knowledge as well. But with The Number Mysteries, you're trying to quite simply break down complex mathematical problems in ways that the public can really start to engage and unpick them. But you use Pollock as your example, don't you?
That's right. I think mathematics is the language of nature. It's hiding under absolutely everything. And in this book, The Number Mysteries, I really wanted to show, you know, as you said, to try and integrate mathematics into culture and show that it's everywhere in music, in architecture, but also in art. And I think what's exciting is that very often I'll find quite a lot of common ground with artists, especially musicians, but also visual artists as well.
You do theatre as well, don't you?
Theater.
I love this idea of you on the stage making maths fun.
Well, I did a lot of work with Complicité. They're a theatre company I've loved ever since I was a student. And I was very lucky to work on a play they did about mathematics. And in that play, I spent a lot of time doing workshops with them. And we were exploring how actually theatre is quite similar in doing mathematics, because theatre is a very sort of abstract space. It's not the real world.
Yeah, you're conjuring up ideas.
You are conjuring up things with the kind of axiomatic framework, and you let these things run. And so actually the process of doing maths and creating maths wasn't so dissimilar from the process of creating theatre. So if I wasn't a mathematician, I'd wanted to run away with a theatre company. So it's just my way of kind
this
of...
This is your secret life coming out now, Marcus. But this idea of the connection with art, it's absolutely fundamental. And you know, previously on The Art Detective, we looked at Leonardo da Vinci. We discussed with Professor Martin Kemp, who of course was a scientist, the implications of looking at art with the scientist's eye. And looking at art with a mathematician's eye now, this is something slightly different, isn't it?
Well, there's clearly a lot of maths in a lot of the art that's been created ever since the Renaissance. You know, to be able to represent a three-dimensional universe on a two-dimensional canvas requires the art of mathematics to project things. And actually, in the Renaissance, you can see people showing off their ability to create three-dimensional objects on a two-dimensional canvas by drawing Platonic solids and Archimedean solids. And that, you know, they're very unforgiving, these shapes. You know, if you draw an apple, okay, if it's a little irregular, it doesn't matter because it might be an irregular apple. But if you're drawing a dodecahedron, well, there's no way you can fake it. So it's a real example. And Leonardo did a lot of drawings of the shapes. Actually, this is what's lovely. During that period, mathematicians rediscovered shapes, Archimedean solids that people hadn't known about, and they needed the artist to actually bring them to life. Mm. So it's not just mathematicians giving artists interesting things to draw. The artists were helping the mathematicians to recover these shapes that Archimedes had talked about. So.
Well, I mean, we probably both experience this when you publish a book and you need illustrations. I suppose what we're looking at in the Renaissance is this relationship between the ideas of the mathematicians' head, what they're trying to visualize in their heads, and then the artists bringing their dexterity and their skill on paper to bear. I mean, I'm thinking now of Dura and Melancholia with that dodecahedron in the foreground, and it's a way of them showing off their virtuosity. You know, pay me to do your portrait because I'm better at drawing these sorts of technical images.
In Melancholia, it's interesting. It's actually not a dodecahedron. It's one of these interesting shapes which is made out of triangles and squares, I think it is. And it is one of these Archimedean solids, there's fascinating stuff in that Dura. I mean, there's, I think, a magic square as well.
Magic square with all the numbers lining up, and then this complete sphere as well. Perfectly.
Again, another very unforgiving object.
Very unforgiving. But anyway, we're drifting away from Pollock, but actually, I was intrigued because of all the forms of art, I would have thought you and I could sit here and talk at length about things like Dura, about things like Leonardo. Of all the art forms, I thought abstract expressionism is probably the, in a way, the furthest from being mathematically precise, but I was wrong.
And this is what's interesting about Pollock, because he's actually creating a geometric shape which is of its time, which is a fractal. We discovered these new kind of shapes in the 20th century, which have this kind of infinite complexity to them. These fractals, anyone who went clubbing during the 80s and 90s probably remembers that they were projected. They're very psychedelic kind of images, the Mandelbrot set. And they arise out of the mathematics of chaos theory. They are the kind of geometry of chaos theory. So they're very 20th century kind of mathematical shapes. So it's interesting that here we have Pollock, you know, like Leonardo in the Renaissance is drawing very classical shapes. Pollock is actually recreating in these paintings these fractal shapes, which are the kind of geometry of our age.
So I think we need to unpack this a bit because I'm struggling with some of the mathematical terminology myself. But this idea then, okay, so fractals, because when I was reading The Number Mysteries, it's about the angles between points, isn't it? Is that right?
No, it's more about a property of a shape is fractal. If you zoom in on it, it never simplifies. So very often a shape you zoom in, suddenly something complex simplifies and you can see how it's built up. These are shapes that as you zoom in, they never simplify. And they sort of seem to replicate themselves at closer and closer scale. Right. It's this quality, this infinite complexity that sort of characterizes a fractal. And what is often called a scaleless shape. It doesn't have a sense of scale. And this is what's magical, I think, about the Pollock, because as you sort of it's quite an interesting exercise to take a Pollock and then take a small zoomed in section and then take another small in zoom section of that one and zoom in again. So you've got four different kind of levels of this Pollock. You put them next to each other, it's very difficult to tell which is the original painting and which is the zoomed in one. At some point, you start to hit the kind of pixelation of the paint. But the quality of a Pollock is that, and you probably experience it, if anyone's seen a Pollock in real life, they're generally huge. But as you go up to them, the fractal quality means that after a while, you're not quite sure how close you are to this shape. And this is the special quality of a fractal, that it, as much as you zoom in, it does not simplify.
And I mean, this is utterly fascinating and slightly mind-blowing. But I do appreciate what you're saying. So coming back to just purely a visual impression of number five that we're looking at, it's been described as a bird nest. And essentially what we've got are these layers of paint built up over these quite free movements. And actually what you were arguing in your book was that you can't fake a Pollock, because we might think what's happened is somebody has literally just splashed paint around. Like you say, the kids finish painting and chuck it around the kitchen. But there's something precise going on here, which is creating this fractal effect, which is unique to him. Is that correct?
That's right. It is actually possible to fake a Pollock if you understand the maths. Because what Pollock was doing was not what my kids are doing, which is, they've got their arms are generally quite fixed at their elbow, at their shoulder, sorry, and they're moving their arm around in quite a regular way. In fact, what they're doing is to making quite a regular sort of pendulum effect.
Ah.
And so the shapes that they create are, you know, they're kind of dripped and splattered and things, but they're actually quite regular in some sense. What Pollock is doing is actually he's moving his shoulder about as he is flicking the paint. It's said that Pollock actually had very bad balance.
Yeah.
So actually when he was standing, he would sort of stagger about a bit. And I even got told that he used to drink a lot when he was, paint a lot when he was drunk.
Well, he was an alcoholic. I mean, that was his downfall, wasn't it?
Actually have contributed to the magic of these paintings.
Gosh.
Because if he's moving around, actually what he's creating is not a regular pendulum, but something we call a chaotic pendulum. So a chaotic pendulum is one which has this kind of irregular behavior. But the geometry of chaos, when you have a chaotic system, which is very sensitive to small changes, the geometry that you get are these fractals. So the way that he was painting was actually creating this visual, which has this kind of strange complexity to it. So there is a way to fake a Pollock,
yeah,
which is to set up a pendulum with a pot of paint on the end. And what you do is you swing the pendulum, but you make sure the where the pendulum is attached is also moving. And this creates what we call a chaotic pendulum. And then the paint effect that you get with this dripping paint has this fractal quality. So it's possible to use, and this has been done actually by a physicist, and it's called the Pollockizer.
Pollockizer.
Yeah, so I actually had a go at doing this. I went over to Pollock's studio, which is in the Hamptons, in Long Island, and it's an extraordinary place, a huge, great big room that he painted in. I actually took a picture of the floor, because the floor is a Pollock painting in its own right, because of course he put these canvases down and then he's flicking paint. A lot of the paint is flying off the canvas onto the floor.
The results. Yeah.
So the floor is an actual Pollock. So I actually took a photo of this and I use it as my desktop on my computer because it's so stunning. But we actually did an experiment whilst we were there, and we set up a Pollockizer and we tried to create something that had that fractal quality that Pollock's paintings had.
Well, you've heard it here now, listeners. If Marcus de Soto suddenly comes up with some auction house, I've got a Pollock. It's a fake one. It's done by the Pollockizer.
Well, actually contrasting to this, there's been a lot of people trying to attempt to fake Pollocks.
Yeah.
But by using a mathematical analysis, we've been able to show that they don't have this fractal quality, that as you zoom in, they actually change kind of texture, and they don't have this kind of infinite complexity. So the mathematics has been used to identify some paintings that people were trying to flog off as Pollocks as actually not Pollocks at all.
This is what I've heard. There was a whole room of presumed Pollocks, and the mathematicians got to work, looked at the, what are the ratios? Because there were numbers that I was intrigued by, 1.5 and 1.7. And so, it was these sorts of ratios that allowed them to determine whether it was a Pollock or not.
So there's something called a fractal dimension, which... So if you think about a line, that has dimension one. But the actual canvas that Pollock is painting on, that's a two-dimensional surface. But these fractals are almost so complex. They're trying to fill the space that we've actually been able to define mathematically a dimension which is between just a simple line and a two-dimensional surface. And so the amount of complexity of a fractal, how much it's kind of filling the space on the canvas, we can measure, and we can give dimensions which sound kind of crazy, of like a dimension of 1.5. Well, what's that? It's sort of halfway between a line and filling the canvas, the two-dimensional space. So, and you can measure... The change in Pollock's work through his life, that he started off with quite low fractal dimensions. During his middle period, which the painting that we're talking about comes from, you hit a kind of fractal dimension of sort of 1.5. The last painting he did, which I think is called Blue Poles. Blue Poles, exactly. Yeah. That is so complex. It's so covered in paint. And the fractal dimension of that is pretty high. But these fake Pollocks didn't have any fractal dimension at all. You measured it and they were pretty much just coming out as simple lines once you did the analysis. So that was the way of telling. But you can also sort of date the periods using this fractal dimension.
It's absolutely amazing to think about it. And I am getting it. Slowly but surely. But presumably if someone wanted to fake a Pollock, it actually comes down to the repetitious action of laying down these layers and layers and layers
but
and layers.
But with the chaos.
The lack of symmetry and harmony that's coming from a regular pendulum effect.
So you need a system. So a chaotic system is one which has incredible sensitivity to small changes. So the weather is an example of a chaotic system that... you might have heard this thing called the butterfly effect.
Yeah, of course.
That a butterfly flaps its wings. That's enough to cause a small change such that a sunny day 5 days later turns into a hurricane hitting Oxford, for example. And the trouble is that nature is controlled by chaotic systems. So they become very hard to be able to make predictions with. This is why this painting relates to the book that I've just written called What We Cannot Know, because one of the limitations of knowledge are chaotic systems. We might have the equations to tell us about the weather, to tell us about planetary motion, to tell us about the economy, but because these systems are very often so sensitive to small changes, we can never have a complete description of the setup such that we can read it into the future. A small change in like the 50th decimal place can cause it to go in a completely different direction.
And this is something you and I have talked about in the past. It's one of those wonderful points where, you know, ideas collide. But I love your latest book. I love this idea of What We Cannot Know, because what you're reaching as a scientist, as a mathematician, is you're reaching the point where you say, actually, I can't predict any further than this. And it's in the realm of belief as much as anything else, isn't it? The unknown.
Well, the unknown, exactly. It's... I'd rather like the theologian who was here in Oxford, Herbert McCabe. He talked about
Personal
the existence
favorite.
Of right, okay, yeah. A Marxist theologian. Yeah. I mean, you can't get better than that.
Awesome.
But Herbert McCabe talked about the idea that, well, God is actually just the fact that there's an unanswered question about the universe.
Yeah.
Religion has very often committed iconoclasm by giving this very abstract idea far too many properties it never should have had. It's a very hard thing to cope with the unknown. And that's why we try and personify it or give it things which actually it should never have. So the book, I'm trying to explore whether scientifically we can identify what will always be unknown.
Yeah.
Sure, there are loads of unknowns. That's what drives me to get up every morning, is trying to solve the maths problems I can't solve or the science problems. But I was interested whether there are any questions that by their nature would always remain unknowable. And chaos theory does, and these fractals actually do tell us that there are parts of the universe that, and part of just the world around us, that although we might know how it works, it's so sensitive that we can't use that to make much, to know what's going to happen next.
To be definitive. I mean, this is the, I suppose, the point at which I was intrigued about talking about Pollock with you, because to me, the abstract expressionist, but Pollock in particular, represents the point at which art, for me, ceases to be something I can make sense of in a logical way and becomes something far more visceral, far more emotional and emotive, and actually quite chaotic. And yet, for you to then say, of all the painters, this is the one that works on a dense mathematical level, I find that absolutely intriguing.
Well, there's another important connection here, which is to nature.
Right.
So I think what we're responding to when we look at a Pollock is that we're seeing an abstract representation of the natural world, because the natural world by its very nature is fractal.
Yeah.
And the things which grow stuff have these chaotic equations. So if you think about, well, yeah, I went to Pollock's studio. What's it surrounded by? Woods.
Right.
And the woods, it was wintertime, and those trees with the branch and smaller branches and smaller branches are examples of fractals. So he was looking at the natural world around him in the Hamptons, and he was representing it on the canvas. Yeah. And the Pollocks that people love, we can measure the fractal dimension of things in nature, and it tends to be around the 1.5.
Yeah.
And so the Pollocks that people love are those that are actually got a fractal dimension, which is very close to those in nature. People don't tend to like the very complex ones or the slightly simpler ones, because they're sort of going out of the bounds of what we feel we're seeing in the natural world.
But it's something I've talked about in the past about the Fibonacci sequence, of course. But this idea, of course, going into Vitruvian Man and the idea of the 2-to-1, we see that replicated in architecture. One of the reasons, I've said this before, but one of the reasons a Palladian villa feels so nice is because it's all done on the principle of 1-to-2. And that idea of feeling comfortable in a space because it's familiar from your own body and also from the natural world is absolutely intrinsic to art, architecture, music. The discordant, the uncomfortable is when you twist against the edges of those assumed proportions.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And harmonies, isn't it?
Yes, but I think you see people think that the Pollock is not connecting to it, but actually they are experiencing something which is highly natural,
that's in this
abstracted sense. This actually can be used because if you want to replicate nature, I went to Pixar Animation to see them making some of their movies.
You get womanized trips.
No, this was a real privilege to be taken, because Pixar is actually founded on the realization that if you want to replicate the natural world artificially in a film or an animation, you can use the mathematics of chaos theory and fractals to do that. That's what Pollock was doing unknowingly. I don't think he realized what he was doing had this mathematical significance. But the people in Pixar really do. They read about Mandelbrot's work on how chaos and fractals create things which look have a very natural feel to them. Mm. So instead of there being animators creating all of those extraordinary backgrounds for a film like Up, if you've seen Up, it's just a wonderful story about the kid and the grandpa going off in the balloon. But they go into the jungle, and all of these jungle scenes are created by mathematical algorithms through exploiting what Pollock was doing, that you can create a very jungle, natural-like environment using an algorithm which creates a fractal.
That is incredible. So the idea that, you know, when you see all the blades of grass or the trees moving, they've just put a program in that's gone, right,
yes,
replicate sort of Pollock-style fractals. That's amazing. That's so interesting. But it does make sense to me, it does. And I think... there is a reason that Pollocks sell for £75 million, because there is a sense of harmony and beauty and rhythm to them that you almost can't put your finger on as a viewer, but the maths allows you to do that.
It does.
Because this is, I mean, we haven't even described the painting. We're halfway through. So it's 8x4 paint, resin, gloss resin paint, but it's yellows, it's browns, it's greys, it's blues. And I suppose it is described as this bird nest quality. The thing that I've always taken away from Pollock is quite how chaotic it is. So I'm intrigued to see that there is a pattern to this splashed paint. What you said something earlier, he's not aware he's doing it. So this is something that fascinates me. He's obviously creating repeated rhythms with this sort of chaotic gait. And I'm struggling still to find how that seemingly kind of random set of events creates something that is so mathematically precise.
Yes, I think, well, I think that he stumbled on a procedure which was very resonant because it had this fractal quality. It was looking very natural, but in an abstract way. But I don't think that he went into it saying, okay, well, I need to create a fractal. How do I do that? Yeah. Well, I need chaos theory. But contrast that with someone like Salvador Dali. Salvador Dali exposed himself to all of these scientific ideas. I mean, he always used to say, you know, I prefer to swim in the hot waters of science rather than the cold waters of art. Yeah. That was where all of the exciting activity was happening. And you've got examples of fractals in Dali's work as well. But they're very deliberate. The Visage of War, which has a skull, and in the three sockets, the two eye sockets and the mouth, you see the skull again, and in those sockets you see, so you've got this infinite regress. It's actually an example of a fractal called a Sierpinski gasket.
My goodness.
Triangles, smaller triangles in smaller triangles. But it's clear that Dali knew what he was doing. He'd learned about fractals. He said, oh, well, that's a really interesting idea. Let's mix that with my kind of weird art. And you get this rather extraordinary image, which has that sense of infinity in it.
Did he pull it off? Because I'm really intrigued by, if it's being done consciously, does he get the qualities correct?
Well, yes, he does. But I think that it's a less interesting painting than these Pollocks, where... because most people who look at a Pollock don't know why it's so special, and that's the mystery of it. It's asking you lots of questions. Why am I finding this so fascinating? Why, as I move towards this, am I losing myself, and I don't understand how big this painting is anymore, because I'm so close, and I just don't know whether it's, I don't know how close I am. Yeah. And we can now understand what that effect is. Dali, I think, sometimes is a little bit too obvious with the kind of images that he's using. I mean, there's some great maths in Dali's work. One of the other ones I love is a four-dimensional cube unwrapped into three dimensions, which he then uses to crucify Christ on. And again, he's thinking of the idea of a fourth dimension being something transcendental. If you're crucifying Christ, there's something else, and he represents that mathematically. Now, I think that works as a painting, because it's
a concept, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it does, unrepresentative and you know, imagining the transcendental. What a wonderful concept! And I like the idea that because there's a realism to Dali, he has to use this in a different way. With Pollock, it's the anti-realism that almost gives the beauty of the chaos visual strength. And it is interesting, isn't it, what makes great art, why Pollock survives, why that name and legend survives. I mean, he died at 44. He had a relatively short career, but there was a huge outpouring. And it is this idea that our eye and our mind are working on a level that we are not consciously in control of or aware of. I mean, is he unique in that? Is that what makes him so great, do you think? Because he's part of the abstract expressionists, isn't he? And they're all trying to kind of touch the intangible. But he does it in that particular way.
It's interesting because you can set up this Pollockizer, which potentially can do the sort of painting that he was doing. But I think that he was, just a master at it. And you can see the evolving practice and the evolving complexity of those paintings. So I do think that it is something that I haven't seen any other painter getting anywhere close to. For me, I often, I'm a mathematician, I'm a scientist, but I spend so much time talking to creative artists, musicians, theatre and art. And what I think we're all doing is trying to interpret the world around us, which, the natural world around us. And we all find our own different languages. Mine is the language of mathematics. Pollock, it was the language of this kind of chaotic drip painting, which again has a mathematics behind it. But a musician will be doing a different thing. But we're all trying to find ways to navigate the natural world around us. And that's why I think I so often find a resonance with a creative artist, that the structures that interest them are often the structures that I'm also working on.
It's so exciting to be able to talk as an art historian with people from different disciplines, because this recurs again and again. And actually, I think it's something our modern day is eroding as we box ourselves up in our different academic discourses. And it's something that the true artist understands almost intuitively and instinctively, that there is mathematical order with everything. Every canvas is structured. Every good painting that works because it is structured. It is either playing with a set of established norms and pleasing compositions, or it's bending those to assault the eye, to do something that makes the eye look differently. And that's absolutely the fundamental basis of looking at art.
I got invited down to St. Martin's, the art college in London, because they've got a new programme which is teaching mathematics. And all of these artists are saying, we didn't get the maths when we did it at school. We didn't understand why it was important. We didn't realize it was going to be the language that we needed. But now we do, and we want to know it. And so they've got a great course, which is just getting people to understand different sorts of geometry. It enables them to build things that they never could before, or to realize that there are structures out there that might be stimulating for their own creative endeavors. So I totally agree with you. Education system across the world has just compartmentalized education. So you go from the art class, the history class, the maths class. You don't realize that all of these things are so interconnected.
I was having this conversation with my children just the other day. They were asking me about going to secondary school. I said, well, you'll have to get yourself from your French class to your history class to your music class. And even in the process of saying that out loud, I thought, how nonsensical is that? We actually make them from a very early age leave one subject behind and walk down a corridor, go into a different room and start another subject. And in fact, that is so destructive to seeing true connections. And as you say, so tapping into this interconnectedness of our understanding of the natural world, trying to actually engage with what it means to be alive and actually functioning in the world, we question it in different ways.
I got asked by Wired magazine to send back a postcard from the year 2024. What my dream for, how the world would have changed. And my postcard was about education. Uh-huh. And I wrote back and said, I just hope that we will realise that we don't need to say, I got an A level in history, English and maths. That people will just say, I've got a diploma in education. And that we will break down the barriers between all of these subjects and just realise that they're not just all vertical subjects. There's this horizontal part to education about looking across subjects. And that's what I love doing with my own subject. Maths is hiding everywhere. It's hiding in this Pollock. And that, I think, is something that people don't realise, that there's just maths bubbling everywhere.
I think it's also something that you and I are both very, very dedicated to, which is reaching out to people who are not necessarily entitled to the sort of educational system that will push them into things like the arts, the theatre, these things that are maybe inaccessible to some. There are ways to get into all these subjects, and it's trying to find that way to connect, trying to find that way to make it comprehensible. I think you do amazing work for maths, and as somebody who I've always been all right at it, but sort of it's not been the way my mind has naturally worked, you make it make sense.
I think that everyone, I have so many people come up to me and say, oh, I don't have a mathematical mind or something. Mm. I think we've all evolved to be very sensitive to pattern, to symmetry, yeah. to structure, to things which stick out as special in our natural world around us. And that is what mathematics is about. It's about structure. It's about pattern. It's about symmetry. It's not about arithmetic.
No.
I'm rubbish at arithmetic. But that, and I think that's what
I
most...
I do not believe that. Well,
I think that most people at school, they just didn't get on with their multiplication tables. They didn't realise that actually that's... It's kind of like the scales of our subject, but music isn't about isn't scales. Yeah, it's built out of scales. But and I think that's that that we all have evolved a brain to be sensitive to structure because it helps us to survive.
And in that word, you said arithmetic. You know, this idea of number puzzles, number work. That is, I think, what turns some people off. Some people think they're numerical learners. Some people think they're linguistic learners. I would class myself as a visual learner because I can retain visuals very clearly. But when you actually break that down and say, what am I retaining when I retain a visual? I'm mapping that image into my mind. I'm creating a very specific pattern of where all the relative pieces of this composition are. And I'm retaining that because that's what my brain can do. That is, it's simply, I suppose, the realization of numbers in that way is what you do with a lot of your work.
Well, I think that mathematicians divide into those who think visually and those who think linguistically.
Yeah.
And myself, I'm really somebody who likes to think of the world linguistically, interestingly. Mm,
interesting.
So, so I study symmetry, which at first sight appears to be an incredibly visual subject.
Art Detective listeners, Marcus has twins, identical twins in real life. And we were just joking about the life replicating art. identical twins. Symmetry, yes.
But for me, what I try and do to understand, the visual world can be very tricky. As Descartes said, I think sense perceptions are sense deceptions. And you can often trick yourself with the visual world. So for me, what I love to do is to take the visual world into something linguistic. So the subject that I use is something called group theory, which takes something which outwardly looks very symmetrical and geometric. I change it into language. The language enables me to manipulate this thing in such ways that I find surprising consequences of these symmetrical objects that I never would have been able to know about. I can create symmetrical objects in higher dimensional space, which can never be drawn on a canvas or made as a sculpture. But with this language, I can actually create a sort of visual world of the mind. Need language to do that. So
this is mathematical philosophy, and it's this sort of sense of imaginative abstraction using language up to the boundaries of its limits. I mean, I suppose this is really mind-blowing for me because I've always seen art as the sort of the non-linguistic high point, that actually when language reaches its conclusion, when a poem can tell you so much or a philosopher can write so much, the artwork cuts out all of that learnt language and gets back to the imagined and the physical. I've always seen art as that higher expression, but actually what you're saying is by being linguistic, you can take things onto a philosophical level that you wouldn't have imagined in the physical world.
That's true. And that very often the visual that you're seeing, which you're finding it difficult to articulate with natural language, maybe a mathematical language will allow... That's why I think we should keep on talking, because I think...
I think we've left behind Pollock about half an hour here, but we're off to deep
I think art history, the understanding of art through this language... The mathematics is the language which helps us to navigate the geometric world and the visual world, and to perhaps create ways of talking about things which our natural language cannot do. And this language of mathematics is the language of the natural world. Actually, one of the conclusions of my book is that what we cannot know is that there's so much mathematics hiding under everything. Maybe the universe is just a physicalized piece of mathematics.
My God.
The mathematics, you know, if we come back to God, very often what motivates people's kind of belief in God is, I don't understand where all of this stuff came from. So I'm just going to call that thing God, the creator of this all. I don't know what that is, and it's an unknown. If you want a creator, it seems to me that you need something which is outside of time. And so what's outside of time? I think that mathematics is the one thing that is actually timeless. It's always there. It's about relationship and structure. And so for me, people kind of often say, oh, God's a mathematician. I would reverse that and say, no, mathematics is the God, which is the creator of all of this. So anything which we see around us, which has some sort of structure, which will include the world of art, probably has a mathematical way of looking at it.
Oh dear, I mean, I'm this close to an expletive because this is just, my head's just gone. God is mathematics, mathematics is God. To me, where the boundaries between, like you were saying earlier, what religion does, and in a way what art does, is dress within a social and cultural norm our attempts to grapple at that endpoint. And so it might be religious art, it might be something that's trying to deal with a philosophical issue, but you can only set it within a zeitgeist. You can only use your reference points within your consciousness of where you get to. And I think we should keep talking, because I think what you've done is taken the next step beyond my idea of the subconscious being expressed within the movement of the hand into the underlying subject matter of the subconscious that's underneath all of that. So blimey, we've started with Pollock and drip painting. We've ended up with the meaning of life.
Which, of course, is the number 42.
Of course, it's number 42. We all know that. We've all heard our Douglas Adams. But no, this is extraordinary. I mean, we've massively overrun. But it's been brilliant. And I think the thing is that it's trying to get, for me, as going back to art and art history, it's trying to put an understanding of why great paintings work. And there is a reason that people return to Pollock again and again. And everybody says it's throwing paint on a canvas, but there is something deeper. And actually what you're getting to is that it's mathematics and potentially God. So we've gone through the whole process. Marcus, what a delight. It's
pleasure.
Been so much fun. Let's do this again.
Yeah.
Have to do something else. Okay, thank you, Art Detective listeners. If you've enjoyed this, please sign up to the podcast, which is at historyhit.com/artdetective. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm Dr. Yanina Ramirez. And Marcus, you're on Twitter, aren't you?
Yes, I'm Marcus DeSotoy.
Marcus DeSotoy. So you must find him on there, follow him, keep up with all his wonderful work at making maths fascinating and accessible. Thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.